If you want to know what climate change looks like right now, there aren't many better places to go than Katie Ayuluk's kitchen table in the village of Nutak in western Alaska. I visited in November. Katie was serving dinner, baked salmon and duck.
You could eat. You could try that.
And I was there for the reason that lots of reporters have visited Nutak, because it's about to disappear. If you look out the window from Katie's kitchen, you see water. It's the Ninglik River, and it's right there. But it didn't used to be like that. Katie says when she was little, the river was so far away, you could barely see it.
What did you see?
Land. It's obvious. Land.
Katie's laughing because this is a question folks here get asked a lot. Nutak was built on permafrost, and it's losing about 70 feet each year as the ground thaws and the Ninglik River eats away at the shore. Along the way, the village has become a kind of international poster child for climate change. But that doesn't make it any less shocking the first time you see it, or any less scary for the people who live here. Katie's in her early 20s. She grew up in this house. She used to go out berry picking on the tundra that's now underwater. She's been watching the river advance her whole life. And now, it's basically in her yard.
This is not gonna even last a year.
Are you worried about this house?
Of course, I have kids to worry about.
Katie and her husband, Dalen, and their two young daughters live here with about half a dozen other family members. It's a small house, just three rooms. And it does not feel like the world's sturdiest structure. And during big storms, the river here acts like an extension of the nearby Bering Sea. Giant waves crash into the shore. Katie and Dalen say it feels like their little house could be swept away.
It's scary. Really scary.
I mean, you're looking at huge swells during a storm.
Even up to this day, it surprises me there's big waves. Even though what I've seen it every day of my life. I need to move. I want to move.
She wants to move now. And she isn't alone. The whole village, nearly 400 people, almost all of whom are Alaska Native, has been trying to relocate for more than two decades. And their situation has raised a new kind of question. What do we owe communities caught in the path of climate change? It's something the U.S. has only just begun to grapple with. But for Nutak, the answer can't come soon enough. As Katie says, the ocean always wins. The erosion isn't going to wait for anyone. Hello and welcome to Midnight Oil from Alaska's Energy Desk. I'm Rachel Waldholz. And this is our second season. We're calling it The Big Thaw. Last time, we looked back at Alaska's 50-year history with oil. This season, we're looking ahead to one of the biggest challenges facing the state now, climate change. Alaska's remote villages are already facing flooding and erosion. Some will have to relocate entirely. They're some of the first people in the U.S. to face this reality, but they won't be the last. Millions of people across the country could be affected by rising sea levels, flooding, and coastal erosion. They live in Miami and New Orleans and New York City. And tiny Nutak might have lessons for them all.
Okie dokie, everyone. Welcome aboard. Thanks for choosing Grand.
Just getting to Nutak is a process. First, you fly from Anchorage to the hub town of Bethel. That flight's in a nice big jet. Then you hop into a tiny little six-seater for the final flight to the edge of the Bering Sea. The pilots are not the most reassuring.
And, like you said, the weather might be a little on the not-so-good side, but it should be a nice flight other than that.
It is a nice flight. In fact, it's breathtaking. As you fly in, the landscape below you is flat. I would say pancake flat, but it's more like Swiss cheese. So dotted with lakes and rivers and sloughs, it looks like more water than land. And checkerboarded beneath all of that, under the surface, is permafrost. That's ground that stays frozen for years or decades or centuries at a time. The permafrost around here, though, is showing signs that it could soon become a lot less permanent. But we'll get to that. When Nutak first comes into view, the village seems impossibly fragile. Just a cluster of houses clinging to the edge of a river. A tiny human toehold in this vast, flat landscape. And that toehold is shrinking.
If you want to understand what Nutak is up against, you can't get a better guide than Katie's husband, Dalen Ayuluk. He's the permafrost tour guy. Dalen is the deputy tribal administrator. He's 31, but he looks younger. Today, he's wearing a gray hoodie and sneakers. We stop in at the village store, and of course, he knows everybody.
As soon as I got on to play, you got off. Now, just about to join you guys on the domino.
They're chatting about online gaming, which kind of blows my mind, because we are way out there in rural Alaska right now. My cell phone stopped working 2 airports ago. And if you haven't been to a village like Nutak, and many Alaskans haven't, the contradictions can be kind of mind-bending. The internet is fast enough for online gaming, but the electricity can go out for days at a time. As we walk through town, there are no roads, just boardwalks snaking their way through the soggy tundra. The modest houses are raised off the ground. The only running water is at the school. Most homes don't have toilets. Instead, they have a 5-gallon bucket, which, ever since the village's sewage lagoon eroded away years ago, gets emptied straight into the river. But Dalen says there's a reason people live here, despite the hardships.
Hi, Gibby.
He married into Nutak when he met Katie.
I was so amazed by this place, you know. Coming from my hometown to another village that's smaller.
This part of Alaska is a constellation of remote villages. Most people are Alaska Native. But Dalen says even compared to other communities across the region, Nutak is more traditional. People still rely on hunting and fishing for most of their food. Most kids grow up speaking the local language, Yupik. And that's how Dalen wants to raise his daughters, the way he was raised.
The way my father taught me was traditional, way of life. Sort of a survival technique, you know, in case, you know, we end up going back to the old ways.
But that way of life is at risk of eroding away with the land.
It's actually closer than I thought.
When we get to the riverbank, even Dalen is surprised by how fast the land is disappearing.
I didn't expect it to be this quick.
People say Nutak is dealing with erosion, but that word does not do it justice. Erosion sounds like something slow and steady. What's happening here is way crazier. The land is breaking off in giant chunks. The village can lose 20 feet in a single storm. Dalen points out a tear in the ground, a sign that this piece of land is starting to rip away. It looks
basically like a wound in the earth, you know, an open wound.
And where the land is breaking off, you can see it, a few feet below the surface, a frozen layer in the ground, ice crystals mixing in with the clay, permafrost.
Like a frozen mud, and you could still see the ice on it.
This frozen layer exists in places throughout this part of Alaska. It's vulnerable. The ground temperature here hovers right around freezing. That means it won't take much warming to start to thaw. And as the permafrost thaws, the land slumps. Meanwhile, the Ninglick River is changing course and eating into the shore. In the past, the river would freeze for much of the winter, and that ice created a buffer against erosion and flooding. But now Dalen says freeze-up comes later.
Back 10 years ago, we would freeze up quick, there'd be much more snow. Now there's no snow. None of the parts of the river is frozen, so.
And the shoreline is left exposed during the region's massive fall storms. One scientist told me this area is facing a quadruple whammy: permafrost collapse, rising sea levels, less ice, and more flooding. He calls it the most vulnerable region in the Arctic. And people talk about the front lines of climate change. I tell Dalen, this is it.
Yeah. The end of our home. Our community. And who knows how long it's going to be here.
If the village goes, people here worry it will take something irreplaceable with it. Nutak's isolation comes with definite downsides, but it's also made the village a kind of cultural oasis, and people here want to hang on to that. So back in the 90s, Nutak's tribal council developed a plan to relocate the whole village, all together, to a new site nearby. The man in charge of getting that plan across the finish line is Romy Cadiente, the village relocation coordinator.
We gotta get him out of here, Rachel. This place is getting dangerous.
Romy's originally from Hawaii, but his wife is from Nutak. They moved back about 15 years ago. And for the last few years, he's had one mission. He's pursuing it with a kind of relentless optimism that comes across as both admirable and a little bit insane. Save Nutak. And do it on Nutak's terms.
One of the plans that we heard is they were actually going to gather all of us up and move us to like Anchorage or Fairbanks. And that is not going to happen.
Romy says residents worry that if they're forced to scatter, they'll lose who they are.
Essentially, what you're really talking about is the preservation of the Yupik community, its traditional values, its identity.
This is something you hear over and over again in Nutak. And to understand what it means, it helps to visit the school.
Good morning.
The school is the biggest building in town. And on a winter weekday morning, it's still dark outside, and the whole school is gathered in the gym. Grant Kashatok is the principal. He starts off every day in Yupik.
What did you say to the kids this morning?
So we call it Yuyarak, which is how to live.
Grant has been the principal here for more than 13 years. He has a kind, scholarly vibe, and he's a kind of self-appointed cultural ambassador. He's used to translating Nutak for visitors. He sees his morning talks as part of a long tradition.
So people have been talking to each other for over 10,000 years, and they did this in the Qazigik, in the communal house. And so because we don't have a communal house anymore, we have the school.
Grant says keeping the culture alive means keeping the language alive. There are about 10,000 Yupik speakers in the U.S. That's more than any other Alaska Native language, some of which are on the edge of extinction. And the future of Yupik may depend on places like this, where English hasn't made the same inroads it has in larger communities, and many kids speak Yupik at home, and the school runs a dual language program. This morning, the third and fourth graders are reciting the Pledge of Allegiance. In Yupik, of course. Across the hall, Bosco Charles is teaching his ninth grade class to introduce themselves traditionally. Bosco grew up here. At 20, he isn't much older than the kids he's teaching. But partway through the morning, he stops the class and sits down at the front of the room with a serious message.
Don't be the generation that kills our culture.
Don't be the generation that kills our culture. It's a heavy thing to lay on the shoulders of ninth graders. But Bosco says it's something they have to hear.
So my generation, in some villages, don't even speak their language. So that's one of the main reasons why I keep myself motivated to speak Yupik, you know, and to keep it in our village and to our people.
The price tag for this way of life is something like $130 million. That's one estimate of how much it will cost to relocate the village. Nutak has been trying to raise that money for years, but in a place where more than 40% of the community lives below the poverty line, the funding will have to come from outside. The problem is there are very few models for this kind of relocation. There are no laws governing how it should be done, no agency in charge. For years, there's been a stalemate. State and federal agencies have pitched in here and there, but nobody's taken responsibility for the whole project. Romy, the relocation coordinator, says that approach isn't going to cut it anymore. Nutak needs a bigger infusion of cash if they're going to move people in time.
And the reason why I said that is we're about 40 feet away from losing a house right now.
That's maybe one or two big storms. Over the years, Nutak has done just about everything they can. The village found a new site and negotiated a land swap with the Interior Department. They've applied for state and federal grants and worked with the military. Finally, they turned to FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, which is responsible for disaster relief. But FEMA says it only has the authority to respond after a disaster. And that disaster has to be caused by a single event, like a hurricane. That means America's main emergency response agency has effectively ruled out action on the slow-moving impacts that are the hallmark of climate change, like coastal erosion. At this point, Romy says there's pretty much only one option.
I mean, so basically you're saying in order to get the kind of funding Nutak needs, you need an act of Congress.
Yes, ma'am. We do. We really do.
An act of Congress to change FEMA's mandate or to address the impacts of climate change.
And if the president could change his position on climate change, I think that would go a long way also.
Listening in on our conversation is Andrew John, the tribal administrator. Andrew's a former Marine. He moved back to Nutak fairly recently. And he says FEMA's failure to step in is particularly bitter.
I was not only hopeful, but I believed that they were going to come. I believed that they were going to help us out.
There's another question that hovers over this endeavor. Is it worth it? There are less than 400 people in Nutak. Relocation will cost hundreds of thousands of dollars per person. Residents here argue that the federal government regularly pays for big projects in urban areas, and the village is a federally recognized tribe with a special relationship with the U.S. government. And Romy and Andrew won't say this, but there's another reason the federal government might have a special responsibility. It's largely because of federal policy that Nutak is here in the first place. On a chilly afternoon, Andrew takes me to visit someone who remembers that history. We're greeted with instant coffee and, to Andrew's delight, cinnamon rolls.
I have been dreaming about Lucy's cinnamon rolls all summer long.
This home belongs to George Carl, the vice president of the Nutak Village Council. George is in his mid-60s. He's a slight, wiry man with a bushy mustache and a pair of surprisingly hip blue glasses perched on his nose. His house is one of the closest to the river.
It's going to reach my house here pretty soon, probably next summer. I'd say next summer or a couple of years at most.
George thinks he'll see the end of this Nutak. He also saw the beginning. He was born a few miles away at a site called Old Kialovik. But in 1958, the Bureau of Indian Affairs built a school. The story goes that the barge with the building supplies could only make it as far as the seasonal camp at Nutak. So that's where it stopped. And that's where the school was built. When George was about 6, his family moved to be near the school. Families from all over the region did the same.
I remember the guy who was telling our parents that if they want to have our kids put in a school, just move here.
And this was happening all over the state. Many Alaska Native families still moved around seasonally. George's family lived in a sod house, the traditional housing built from the tundra. If a river changed directions and a site flooded, the camp could be rebuilt somewhere else. But when the government started building schools, the villages grew around them, rooting people in place. Other infrastructure followed, clinics and airstrips and power plants. But many of the sites were chosen the way Nutak was. Convenience for the builders, not longevity for the village. It's one reason why many of the state's rural villages are so vulnerable to climate change. Because of their locations. Schools did more than simply root people in place. George says the switch was a culture shock.
In our first days of school and listening to English-speaking teachers, you know, I wasn't understanding nothing at all, just totally nothing.
Students weren't allowed to speak Yupik, but many fundamental ways of life, those continued. For George, life in Nutak still revolves around subsistence, hunting and fishing. This time of year, for instance.
That's the time to go muskrat, mink, and otter, and a beaver sometimes, you know.
While we're talking, one of George's grandsons comes in with a bag of tubers gathered out on the tundra. George says this is the whole point of living out here.
Would you think about moving to, like, Anchorage or Bethel or another village?
No, Dad, I don't think so.
Why?
Because my, I'm adapted to the Mother Nature and the ocean and the river.
He says moving to a city would make his life impossible, and a way of living that survived decades of government intervention might not survive that. The solution to all of this, the place where Newtok wants to move, is tantalizingly close. Just a 20-minute boat ride up the Ninglick River. On a cold November afternoon, I load onto an open skiff with Romy, their relocation coordinator, Andrew, the tribal administrator, and Dalen, my guide. It's a very bumpy ride upriver into a brutal winter wind. But Andrew John is unfazed.
We're going to heaven. That's what it feels like when we're there, you know? It's beautiful.
Heaven is Murktarvik, the new Newtok. It sits on the side of a low mountain, about 9 miles from the current village. Newtok got this land in an exchange with the federal government during the George W. Bush administration. And over the years, they have managed to get some things built. From the water, you can see a handful of houses along a makeshift road. There's a row of heavy equipment waiting for the next construction season.
You crooked Parker, you.
As we walk up the hill, Andrew lays out Newtok's plans for this site. Roughly 100 homes. Gravel roads instead of the sinking boardwalks at the current location. And running water.
Something as simple as washing your face in the morning. You know what I mean? Warm water coming out of a faucet.
The view from the new site is stunning. From up here, you can see for miles. Andrew explains why this view matters.
It's a part of who we are. This is our land. Upriver from the current village of Newtok are my ancestral roots. Houses, sod houses, built by my grandmother's grandfather and his father and their fathers before them.
The fact that his people might have to leave this behind, Andrew says he feels abandoned. Newtok has worked so hard to make this new site a reality, and he says it feels like the rest of the country won't even meet them halfway.
We're Americans too. And I, as a veteran, have fought in the forces in which safeguard our country and our way of life. And now I'm home, fighting for my people and our way of life. I'm sorry.
Dalen breaks in. He asks, what would you do if your home was being taken away?
We grew up here. We fish here. We hunt here. I mean, our community doesn't want to separate. We want to live together. So it's like asking, why destroy that?
Has come from an unexpected direction.
Thank you very much, everybody. We have a lot of good news to report.
This spring, President Donald Trump signed a massive spending bill, and tucked away on page 458 was a small miracle. The Alaska delegation had managed to insert $15 million to help Newtok relocate. The day Trump signed the massive spending bill, George Carl, the village council vice president, and Romy Cadiente, the relocation coordinator, sat down in a conference room in Midtown Anchorage. Romy was visibly relieved.
You know what, Rachel? This couldn't have come at a better time.
George simply said the money is life-changing.
I'm really excited, and it's like saving our people in that small village.
The $15 million is nowhere near the total amount Newtok needs, but it might be enough to jumpstart the move to Murktarvik. The village plans to use the money to build homes at the new site and have at least some people moved over within the next year and a half. Romy says it's lost on nobody that the funding came from a Republican Congress and a Republican White House, both dominated by climate change skeptics.
We were really surprised that something like that happened. Maybe the tides are turning. I don't know.
But he points out that this is a one-time fix. It might get Nutak closer to the finish line, but it doesn't do anything for other communities facing the same situation. Back in the house where Katie and Dalen Ayuluk live, the talk has turned to what comes next. Katie says she's slowly started preparing to move.
I've talked to my mom about packing things up, and I am slowly putting things away for her because she's an elder now. So I'm helping her with a lot of things.
For now, the house is crowded but cozy. There are kids' toys all over the living room floor. The TV is on low. And as I talk to Dalen at the kitchen table, his friend tunes a guitar on the couch, and Katie settles in to sing Inupiaq. If all goes according to plan, Nutak might actually start to move after more than two decades of waiting and trying. But right behind them are three other Alaska villages that might need to relocate soon, and dozens more that need help dealing with erosion. And behind them, communities across the U.S., from Florida to Washington State. They aren't all dealing with permafrost, of course. Each place has a different challenge. But what they have in common is that climate change is making it harder to live where they live. And there's no plan for what to do next. They can't all rely on a special act of Congress. People in Nutak hope they can become a model for how a community adapts to climate change, but they also know that their experience serves as a warning. If it's this hard to move 400 people, how are we ever going to move millions? And if the U.S. does try to answer that question, one of the people involved will likely be Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski. In our next episode, we ask, how does an oil state senator deal with climate change? Thanks for listening to Midnight Oil from Alaska's Energy Desk. If you like what you hear, rate us on iTunes or tap Interesting on NPR One to help more people find the show. This story was edited by Annie Feit and Jennifer Pemberton and mixed by Dave Waldron. James Claves composed our theme music. We had help from Allison McAdam, Elizabeth Harbaugh, Zachariah Hughes, Emily Kwong, Emily Russell, Casey Grove, Elizabeth Jenkins, and Liz Ruskin. In addition to the voices in the story, thanks to everyone who helped us understand these issues, including the Nutak Village Council and its president, Paul Charles, Jimmy Charles Jr., Albertina Charles, Mike Wallery, Joel Niemeyer, Jay Farmwald, and Don Antrobus at the Denali Commission, Vladimir Romanovsky, Tor Jorgensen, Sally Russell Cox, and Robin Bronin. You can find more stories about energy and environment in the last frontier from Alaska's Energy Desk at alaskapublic.org. I'm Rachel Waldholz. This is Midnight Oil.
Support for The Big Thaw comes from the Leedy Foundation and from the listeners of Alaska Public Media. Become a sustaining member today at alaskapublic.org. Thank you.